One of the things about Jesus that we can absolutely historically verify is that he loved to tell stories. It was one of the characteristics of his whole ministry, particularly these parables. I mean, it makes sense because there isn't a child, or when we were children, you know, when we were wanting to go to sleep, how many of us, when our parents were there saying, oh, come on, it's time to go to bed, time to go to sleep, and be like, oh, come on, Mom, Dad, can we just have one more story? You know, we just love hearing stories, and that sense of story permeates our whole sense of identity. And I think it's something that we really need to learn as the church. Rather than always expecting to have answers to all of life's complex questions, you know, how would Jesus answer a particular moral question that we might be facing? Well, he'd say, a man had two sons. And he said to one of the sons, you know, like, it's that sense of just opening us to the story. There's about 40 parables that Jesus tells across the first three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. John doesn't seem to relate those senses. He will tell lots of metaphors or ways that Jesus kind of compares himself to the gate or to the vine or to the sheepfold, things like that. But it's in the first three Gospels that he tells these stories. The kingdom of heaven is like this. So this parable that we hear tonight is one of the ones that is unique to the Gospel of Luke. And it follows directly on from the set of three equally unique parables that we heard last week. The three parables about the lost things or the found things. The coin, the sheep, and then the sons. And so it follows directly on. There's no break. There's no change of scene. There's no change of characters. It's just another parable that Jesus tells among this set of people wanting to be found. And so perhaps the steward and the master are both to be found in that same complex reality. But it's a troubling parable for us because it kind of defies all of the sense. We love looking for moral lessons in our parables, which is probably a mistake in the first place. But we're offered very little here. We're told about this dishonest, this cheating steward who's employed by this rich master. So already both characters would be disdained by the people who are hearing them. No one who is rich in a world where there's just absolute poverty is esteemed or valued. People don't like that. I mean, even today, the top eight billionaires in the world own more wealth than the lowest 4 billion people in the world. 8 billionaires have more wealth and more property than the lowest 4 billion people in our world. How is that about equality? How is that about the full flourishing of human life and expectation? And yet this sense of these strange characters in our story tonight, we do need to get a little bit more context from the times. The first thing we know is that the Jewish law, the law of the Torah, prohibited Jews from lending and charging interest on loans. So one of the ways that the Jewish people, and they're clever in these ways, was to perhaps to cook the books a little bit. So if you owed 50 measures of wheat or 50 measures of oil, then when the person came to write it down in their ledger, rather than writing the 50 that was actually owed, they would say, okay, well, let's say you owe me 100. So that if anyone asks, it was just 100 originally. So the profit margin, all of the interest, all of that is just hidden in the books by the larger number. So when the steward is dismissed because of whatever dishonesty he was engaged in, he's still acting as the steward of the master at this point. No one knows that he's been publicly dismissed. That information hasn't yet been made public. So he's got this little window of an opportunity, a chance to do what he needs in order to try and win friends and influence people the best way that he knows possible. And he knows that this cheating that the master is doing is his way into this. He's able to remove that excess profit and to find the favor of the people saying, well, I don't have to pay the interest. You know, as mortgages increase and as interest rates rise, people, I'm sure, would love the opportunity to not have to pay the interest on their loans and to be able to pay back their loans much more quickly. And so this, I think, is what the thing that we don't really understand from the system and the way that the world worked at the time within that Jewish world. So what the master in the parable, and again, it's the master, it's not Jesus who's praising the steward, but he's telling the story. It's a parable. It's not offering us insights into how to do business or how to manipulate people. None of that. If we think that, we're missing the point of what a parable is about. It's meant to shock us. It's meant to leave us asking these questions. I mean, elsewhere in the Gospels, Jesus says that he uses parables so that people will see and not see. They will hear and not understand. It's not about this clear teaching that we like. You know, we like things to be short, simple, succinct, and able to be easily explained. You know, those explainer videos that we have on YouTube, those things we're able to get into to be able to understand something really quickly and easily. Parables are not about that. Parables leave us kind of pondering and wondering, but they kind of challenge us and leave us wondering what this is all about. And then either Jesus or Luke, scholars don't really know, adds these extra lines of moral instruction at the end, verses 10 to 13. And interestingly, the short version of the gospel cuts out the parable entirely and just gives us the little moral teaching at the end. Things about that we can't be, we have to serve either money or God. We can't try and serve both. You can't have two masters. You can only have the one. And it's an invitation to really ponder about where our priority has to be. I mean, we've corrupted the English language in strange ways. The word priority is one of them. When the word first came into the English language in the 18th century, it presumed that you could only ever have one priority. What is your priority? What's the one thing that you have in life? Now we rank them. Now we order them. Now we say, oh, well, the 25 priorities that I will establish in my life. But, you know, we know that if we have 25 priorities, we're not going to actually achieve any of them. We need to have the one that we fix our hearts on, the one thing that we give ourselves fully and completely to. And this parable invites us into that reflection on how do we do that? How do we find the one thing that is necessary for us? And how often do we try and mix that with so many other things that we kind of add to the mixture, things that we think, oh, well, that's a good thing. It's not a terrible thing. It's not sinful. It's not horrible. But that's not the point. The point of this is that God is inviting us to the fullness of life. He's inviting us to surrender. And it's only when we surrender and give ourselves fully to God, when we embrace his love and allow his love to call us more deeply into the plan that we have, that God has for our lives, that we will find that freedom, that we will find that life, that we will find that ability to get rid of all of the stuff, all of the things that prevent us from being free and allow us to surrender into the goodness of God. But this is about justice. This is about being free in order that we will be free to serve, in order that we will be able to use the money that we have to care for the poor, to look after those who are the most vulnerable, to give to worthy causes and charities. It's not simply about this spiritual reality that has no impact whatsoever on our practical and material life, but it's about making God the first and only priority in our life, and then everything else flowing naturally from that, in surrendering to God, and offering our hearts to him, and letting his love call us more deeply into that fullness of life that only God is able to offer to us. Tonight, once again, we get that choice. Tonight we get to make that decision to surrender just a little bit more to God, to be generous in our giving, to offer our hearts to him, and to know he's got us. He's filled us with this joy, and he will continue to sustain us and find us within us that ability to find life today. Let's make that choice. Let's surrender our lives once again to the Lord and allow him to embrace us with his call and to give us that freedom that we need to serve God and nothing else in our lives.